This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When President Nixon signed the Endangered Species Act 30 years ago this week, there was no photo op at Yellowstone Park and no news conference. The White House released a 3-paragraph press release which read, in part, "Nothing is more priceless and more worthy of preservation than the rich array of animal life with which our country has been blessed." Well, that was then. 3 decades later, the Endangered Species Act is regarded as one of the most powerful and one of the most controversial pieces of environmental legislation ever enacted. Today, in the first of a 2-part series, we'll revisit the genesis and the evolution of the law. Next week, a look at where we go from here. Join the conversation. What are your questions about the life of the Endangered Species Act? Our number in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now on the phone from here in Washington is Congressman John Dingell, a Democrat from Michigan. He was one of the original authors of the Endangered Species Act, and good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What was the idea behind this? Was there one issue that motivated you to help write this bill?
Well, the Endangered Species Act is one of the most moral and, frankly, one of the wisest and best pieces of legislation I believe the Congress has passed or could have passed at that particular time. Its basic thesis is that the expiration and the extinction of species of fish, wildlife, plants, animals should not occur at the hand of man. If it occurs naturally, as it oftentimes does, then that is the will of God and that is the way of nature. But that mankind should do everything it can do to prevent the loss of species and their habitat. So 2 functions were there. One, to protect the species themselves, to halt the trade in these species and their parts, and to eliminate the economic advantage for destroying the species. And second, to preserve and protect their habitat insofar as it was possible to do.
Was there one species in particular that you were worried about at the time?
No. Who knows what species is next, and who knows what species is most important to us? All of them have their place in nature. Obviously, there are species like the peregrine falcon, the grizzly bear, the bald-headed eagle, who either were threatened or endangered either across or in parts of their habitat. That was important. But there's a lot of others, things like plants of different kinds, whose function, believe it or not, can for human beings be to define new mechanisms and new medicines for saving us from things like cancer and other things like that, which are enormously valuable.
Now, 30 years ago, was this a controversial item?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, it passed the House 391-12. It passed the Senate 92-0. It was passed by a Democratic Congress working together in an open bipartisan fashion. It was signed by a Republican president who made much of it and who felt that it was a good thing to do. President Nixon, I certainly think, is to be honored for having so signed the legislation. But in addition to that, remember that while this was passing, things like the National Environmental Policy Act, the Marine Mammals Protection Act, ocean dumping legislation, and other important legislation to protect the environment and the habitat of fish and wildlife, and indeed to protect the environment of human beings, was being passed by the Congress without partisan controversy and in an open fashion.
Well, let's bring Brock Evans into the conversation. He's currently executive director of the Endangered Species Coalition, and he's with us here in Studio 3A. 30 years ago, he was director of the Sierra Club's Washington office, lobbied on behalf of the Endangered Species Act. Good of you to be with us today.
Thank you.
What do you recall, in addition to what Congressman Dingell has said, about the passage of the Act 30 years ago?
Well, I certainly agree with Congressman Dingell. I was privileged to lobby and help its passage, but it was, as he pointed out, it was not controversial at all. It was sort of ho-hum. What could be more obvious than to protect all the species that inhabit this national territory with us? And we all thought, yes, it's a profound moral statement. It's uniquely American in its optimism and its hope, like the Parks Act or Wilderness Act. We can fix these things and do these things. So it seemed an obvious thing. We were at that time much more focusing much more attention on the Alaskan oil pipeline, which was that year. The first so-called energy crisis happened that autumn, as a matter of fact. There was this word impeachment looming on the horizon, and everybody's attention was focused on that because this was a slam dunk as far as we were concerned. It wasn't controversial at all, which is why it passed by such huge majorities.
What kind of feedback did you get from the bill when you were lobbying for it?
Yeah, this is a good idea, yeah. Isn't it? And yes, people would think about endangered species of the day, like the alligator, which was on the list at the time, and the brown pelican. But there were many other species, as the congressman pointed out, of smaller, so-called more insignificant species. And even President Nixon talked about ecosystems, and so did the committee report. It was just an obvious thing to us at the time. We had no idea the profound effect it would have on the country in saving, because, as you know, the act requires to protect not just the individual animal or plant, but to protect its habitat, the places where it eats and feeds and reproduces and sleeps and so on. And because of this law, millions of acres of forest are still standing that would be cut down otherwise. Millions of acres of open space are protected. Millions of acres of wetlands and swamps are protected. And those are priceless gifts that Congressman Dingell and his colleagues were wise enough to pass on to us.
To save the clutter in your email and mine, we will say less charismatic and not less significant species.
Very good. Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. I stand corrected.
Congressman Dingell, I guess things began to change a little bit. I think it was, about 5 years after the passage of the act in 1978, and this was the controversy where construction of a dam was halted because of a tiny fish called the snail darter.
That was Tellico Dam and the snail darter. It is quite possible within the statute, had that ever actually been approached properly by TVA and by the proponents of the dam, that both could have gone forward, the protection of the species and also the construction of the dam. The thing that the dam constructors and others never take a look at is to see that there is, in fact, a process within the statute under which normal, intelligent steps to protect the species as alternatives to the construction of the facility or the construction or whatever it is that is sought to be done can be done. It is not just a straitjacket. It is something the statute is something which permits progress to be made, but requires it to be intelligent progress with careful concern to the protection of the species. And also, it does it in a way which doesn't consider economic consequences. The questions before it, of course, are simply scientific.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember, Brock Evans, when the first lawsuit was filed over the Endangered Species Act?
No, but I assume it was within the late 70s at some particular point in time, because, or maybe a little bit later. One of the great beauties of the Act, it's one of the few laws we have that is enforceable by ordinary citizens. So instead of having to rely on the federal agencies to do their job as required by the Act, and they often don't do it for political reasons, political pressure or whatever, ordinary citizens that are concerned about the loss of species in their area can file lawsuits too and require that things be done because of the way the law is written. So I'm sure once people became aware of all this, and Congressman Dingell may know exactly when that part of the law was added in, then lawsuits would come because people realized that agencies weren't going to do it on their own. I could say one more thing about that. In 1966, we had a law like the Endangered Species Act, but basically it said to the agencies, oh, please protect species if you can, if it doesn't hurt anything else you're trying to do or stand in the way of your logging program or your dam building program. Nobody did anything. That's why Congress got upset about it and changed the law in 1973 to require them to do things.
Well, Congressman Dingell, it certainly started out, as you say, with bipartisan support, overwhelming bipartisan support, and non-controversially, but it became more and more controversial over time as various groups became involved in efforts to rein in the Endangered Species Act because they said it was getting in the way of a lot of things that they wanted to do.
Well, it was getting in the way of a lot of things they wanted to do and the way they wanted to do them. First of all, I want to say something about the climate at the time. The climate was open. It was bipartisan. People like Brock Evans and others and my colleagues John Saylor and Tom Pelly and John Allen and others, Ed Forsyth, Republicans and Democrats alike, understood that we had to work together. But we also understood that we had to write a piece of legislation which would take care of all considerations. The basic policy and concern we had was to protect the species, but we allowed mechanisms to be in place, which the opponents of the statute now have never paid any attention to, and that is to permit alternative mechanisms to protect the species and the habitat so that the species would not be wiped out. It was a very wise, thoughtful, open, bipartisan process, but it was one in which there was a lot of give and take both before and after. It should be noted that there's a specific exemption for the military, which the military now actively disregards and has sought a specific relief from the statute in legislation now pending before the Congress.
And Brock Evans, over time, this has become more and more confrontational, as people on the environmental side say the government is not doing enough to enforce it, as other people say as developers and other people say that this is getting in the way they want to do it. It's described as the piece of legislation most hated in the western part of the United States, whether that's accurate or not.
I would say that there are a number of groups in American society that don't like the law, but there's one group that loves it. And they're called the American people. If you look at the polls, overwhelming, people don't want to see other species that they inhabit this territory with to go extinct. They just don't want to. And as Congressman Dingell pointed out, it's not so much a matter of not being able to do your housing development or your logging project or whatever it might be. It's how you do it and where you do it. You can move the road. You can move the development in such a way through a process set forth by the Act. And then do it anyhow, but the species lives too. And that's the whole aim of it. It's an incredibly flexible law. It's been painted by its opponents, who see their political opportunity right now as an inflexible law, but it's just the reverse, just the opposite.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Steve, who's in Reno, Nevada.
Hi, greetings.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention the spotted owl. I know it gets a lot of blame for the downturn in the logging industry in the 80s. But in the 1980s, we were selling raw lumber to Japan. They were loading trucks up with, still cutting down trees, loading up the trucks, going right past lumber mills, and not milling the lumber in Oregon, but sending raw lumber to Japan, and that was the cause of big cause of the economic downturn in Oregon in the 80s. It had nothing to do with spotted owls.
Well, I think something on the order, if I remember the research correctly, 19,000 forestry jobs have been lost in Oregon and Washington. Now, those two states, of course, now are in the midst of, I think they have the highest unemployment rates in the country, and I think there's plenty of blame to go around. But, Steve, I think the spotted owl controversy gets part of it.
Well, the controversy over the spotted owl has been solved by agreement, and the spotted owl is now protected. Timbering goes on in the Pacific Northwest and down through the range of the spotted owl. The spotted owl is going to continue to exist. An important principle has been protected, and that is that we will protect endangered species. And in addition to that, the lumber industry is prospering in the western United States. Now, the point that was made is very good. There was this process of wild plundering of our timberlands. That has to be done with thoughtful consideration of other things. Remember that it relates not to the handling of land on timbering on private lands, but it relates to the handling of timber on the vast stands of public land in the western United States. And there was where the protection was in existence. The loggers are working, the timber is falling, the timber is available for the homes. And some of the rascally practices of taking the timber direct to Japan or to Japanese ships offshore for processing and then returning to the United States has been stopped.
Steve,
but
thanks.
The spotted owl is there, and the timber is going on. The jobs are going forward, and the industry is prospering.
Steve, thank you very much for the call. Congressman Dingell, we appreciate your time today.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's good to talk to you. I hope things go well for you.
Thank you. Congressman John Dingell, a Democrat from Michigan, one of the authors of the Endangered Species Act. Brock Evans, thank you for your time. He was with us here in Studio 3A. More after a break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how the Endangered Species Act started as an innocuous, beloved law and transformed to one that causes great friction between liberals and conservatives. You're invited to join our discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn NPR.org. Just a reminder, this is part one of a two-part series. We're looking at the history and the evolution of the law today. Next week, we'll be talking about where we go from here. Joining us here in Studio 3A to continue the story of the Endangered Species Act is Michael Bean, chairman of the Wildlife Program for Environmental Defense. Good of you to join us.
Thank you.
And we've heard about, the snail darter being the trigger for the first major controversy. That went to the Supreme Court, did it not?
Yes, indeed. In 1978, the Supreme Court held that the Endangered Species Act required that Tellico Dam, a Tennessee Valley Authority dam, not be completed because the completion of the dam would destroy the snail darter and what was then believed to be its only known habitat.
And the reaction to that in Congress was volatile.
Congress responded to that by amending the law. They, however, did not direct the completion of the dam, at least not initially. Rather, they created a process for considering exemptions for projects that met certain criteria of economic necessity, and they directed that Tellico Dam be the first project to be considered in that process. Ironically, when the committee that was established, which was comprised of cabinet-level officials, considered whether Tellico Dam would meet the criteria, they found that it did not. And thus, Tellico Dam was not allowed to go forward until Congress, in another opportunity, decided to, in the small hours of the night, pass a rider to an appropriations bill directing that the dam be built. So it was built.
And what happened to the snail darter?
The snail darter is gone from the Little Tennessee River where the dam was built. It does still survive in a few other localities where it was not known to survive in 1978. So it survives but is still very much a threatened species.
As a caller mentioned at the end of the last segment, I guess the next major controversy was the spotted owl.
Yes, the spotted owl controversy took place in around 1990 and for a few years thereafter. It was unlike the Tellico Dam controversy in that it had a regional impact. It affected an industry throughout the Pacific Northwest. And I think that, perhaps even more so than the Tellico Dam controversy, really galvanized the attention of potentially regulated parties. But it also sparked, I think, some real interest in finding ways to make the act really work effectively, particularly on privately owned lands.
Let's get some callers in, 800-989-8255. And Moji joins us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi. I had a computer crash, so I lost the source of where I got this information about a year ago. And it has the rate of loss of species or subspecies or subspecies or subsubspecies of plant, animal, and microorganisms, which include microbes and viruses, is 1 per hour. And I want to know whether your guest finds this estimate to be reasonable. To me, it's reasonable because the rate of the loss of soil series out of 15,000 approximate soil series that have been identified, 1,000 of them are endangered.
Well,
so 1 per hour.
Is that a reasonable estimate?
I think no one knows for certain how many species we are losing, but I think it is well established amongst scientists that the rate of extinction occurring today is dramatically higher than what we would expect through natural processes alone, and it's entirely due to human changes on the habitats of the Earth.
What about subspecies, including bacteria and viruses?
I would say that probably nobody knows what the rate of loss among bacteria and viruses are. I would point out that the Endangered Species Act does not protect bacteria and viruses. It protects plants and animals only.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Raul in New York City.
Yes, hello. My question is, if there was enough scientific evidence that a species was being threatened by global warming, would that force the government to do something about global warming?
Well, potentially, if we had evidence of that sort, some provisions of the Endangered Species Act would require federal agencies to take action against those threats. At this point, we don't have that specific of information for any particular listed species, however.
Don't we have information, though, that some species are migrating generally further north in general the environment heats up? And if they're talking about protected climate area and protected areas for habitat, wouldn't those shift as well?
Yes, indeed. That's one of the major concerns with the global warming, which is the parks and reserves that have been established for many of our wildlife will cease to be suitable for them as climate shifts northward, and yet those species themselves may not be able to shift northward with the shifting climate.
Thanks, Raul.
Okay, thanks.
Here's an email from Michael Tom in Alameda, California. The Endangered Species Act supports species which have little hope of returning to normalcy, especially considering the fact that they're no longer capable of maintaining genetic viability. Perhaps two decades after the fact, a better approach might be to support and maintain biodiversity.
Well, the purpose of the Endangered Species Act certainly is to help in the preservation of biodiversity. The caller or the emailer is certainly correct that many of the species that the Act now tries to protect are in desperately dire situation. And indeed, in many cases, they were allowed to achieve a very dire situation before they were put on the protection of the endangered species list. However, we have made some fairly dramatic recoveries or dramatic improvements. The whooping crane is a good example. 40 years ago, there were fewer than 20 whooping cranes in all of the Earth, and now there are in excess of 200. Several separate populations have been established, and that is an indication of what can be accomplished through perseverance and serious effort.
Yet some species obviously continue to vanish and go extinct. More become endangered, as you've mentioned. Is there any way to gauge how much of this is due to human interference, or as Congressman Dingell mentioned at the beginning of the program, they're unable to compete somehow?
I think the prevailing view among scientists is that the overwhelming majority of those species that are now facing the risk of extinction do so because of human interference with the environment.
Let's go to Paul, and Paul's with us from Charleston, South Carolina.
Hello. I'd like to agree with the consensus of the show here today that I think the Endangered Species Act is one of the real hallmarks of legislation for a real civilized society like we have here in America. I also end up seeing the effect every day in the course of my job of that very same act taking the ability of small landowners to develop their property the way they want to. Do you think that the government ought to be in a position to be able to compensate those people for that, in effect, that taking that the Act creates?
I think you said you're from North Carolina. We've been working in North Carolina
He said South Carolina.
South Carolina, anyway. Sorry. We've been working in South Carolina, too, over the last decade or so. And indeed, there are about 300,000 acres worth of privately owned forest land in South Carolina that is currently being actively managed voluntarily by the private landowners for the benefit of an endangered bird called the red-cockaded woodpecker. And this is being done pursuant to a program called Safe Harbor, which is one of the mechanisms by which the Endangered Species Act is working with private landowners, allowing them to become allies of conservation, not its adversaries. And so while there certainly have been some tensions between private landowners and conservationists, this is one of the tools that is allowing bridges to be rebuilt between those private landowners and conservation interests.
Thanks for the call, Paul.
You're welcome.
Joining us now is Richard Stroop. He's a senior associate with the Property and Environment Research Center, and he's with us on the phone from his office in Bozeman, Montana. Good of you to be with us today.
Good to be here.
And I mentioned earlier that the Endangered Species Act may be the single most unpopular piece of legislation in the western part of the United States. Would you say that's accurate?
Well, certainly it's a good candidate for that. And unfortunately, it's not just because of landowners being threatened or harmed, but it's the list of species themselves, I think, that are actually paying a good part of the price for the train wreck. There are a series of train wrecks that are happening.
And why do you call it a train wreck or a series of train wrecks?
Well, unfortunately for the species, let's think pro species here for a minute and not worry too much about the landowner as such, but the ESA, the way it's now enforced, really acts like a sort of Damocles over the head of every landowner. It in effect, clouds every title. That is, the desire for habitat for the species by law now, by a very clear law, trumps any desire of any landowner, public or private. And that what that does then is it destroys almost all likelihood that most landowners who could potentially be low-cost providers of habitat for listed species will now voluntarily either look for ways to do it or even allow other people to help enhance the habitat on their land. In the prior century, we have lots of documented cases where landowners were happy to work with people supporting an endangered species. Wood ducks, eastern bluebirds, there are lots of cases where people passionate for those critters were able to enlist private landowners and sometimes public too, to help the birds or whatever they were by, for example, allowing the introduction by the supporters of nest boxes, specifically designed nest boxes that work for those species. Now it's very, very difficult to even get a landowner to consider such a thing, because to improve the land for their land for that species is to invite the species in, and once they're in, then the regulator trumps. Nothing the landowner does or wants to do has any meaning against a claim by the regulator. And it's well intended. It's intended to do something very important. But the downside is it's that sort of Damocles that tends to be able, at least, to destroy land values. It doesn't always do that, but sometimes it does. And we have good statistical evidence, econometric evidence, that in the case, for example, of red-cockaded woodpeckers, that all over the Southeast, North Carolina, South Carolina, the whole area there, landowners are, in fact, cutting their trees earlier. Landowners are, in fact, tweaking their land management to make it less attractive to these listed species and encouraging their neighbors to do the same in order that they don't get shut down, that they can't any longer use their land the way they have in the past.
Let me bring you back into this, Michael Bean, and another problem that has developed with the Endangered Species Act a lot of people complain about is that, in fact, management of the act has been so tied up in lawsuits that it's pretty much administered by court order now.
Well, let me first address Richard Stroop's comment. I think what he had to say may have been true a decade ago. I can tell you it is not true today, because we are working with landowners throughout the Southeast, restoring habitat, indeed installing nest cavities for red-cockaded woodpeckers. There are currently between two and three million acres of privately owned land that is being actively managed pursuant to safe harbor agreements in order to provide habitat for endangered species, including in Texas, a very large amount of land that is being used to restore the northern Aplomato falcon on private land. This is an example, I think, of an approach that has been non-contentious, non-adversarial, as a good example of what can be accomplished without resort to litigation. It is certainly true there has been much litigation, but there have been many other forms of progress as well.
We're speaking with Michael Bean and Richard Stroop about the 30th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And you were about to say something, Richard Stroop. I didn't mean to cut you off.
If I could read you a sentence from the Washington Post Sunday, December 14, second paragraph of this article says, U.S. District Judge Emmett G. Sullivan struck down the No Surprises Rule that helped secure protection for nearly 40 million acres of wildlife habitat around the country under agreements known as habitat conservation plans. The Secretary of the Interior and the Fish and Wildlife Service can, in fact, make deals like this, but the way the ESA has been interpreted in the courts, I believe they have no real force in law, and that's what the judge just ruled. And I think, unfortunately, the way things have been interpreted in the past, he was probably right about that. It's most unfortunate. I think Michael Bean is talking about a very positive program, but I think it doesn't have a good basis in law. Now, maybe the Congress can do something to change that and make possible what Michael Biehn is trying to do. That would be great. I haven't seen them do it, and the courts, I think, are going to strike down anything that gets in the way of this law trumping every other consideration, period.
And that was the no surprises, and then the safe harbor is a different group.
That is correct. Two different things.
But they may be related. They may rule, but that's a subject for another program and perhaps next week. Let's go to Thor, and Thor is with us from Rock Springs, Wyoming.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Good afternoon.
I measure every day as to whether or not I get to listen to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you very much,
Thor. And I want to switch from private land back to public.
Okay.
I work for the Bureau of Land Management, and I think the Endangered Species Act is a wonderful law. We are going to run into some troubles here in the future, however, when we have, where we're managing for a single species and its habitat in an ecosystem, we eventually get our hands tied and we can't manage the ecosystem anymore. One comment. The other is that we almost had a case out here with the mountain plover and the sage grouse, whose habitat requirements are nearly diametrically opposed, and they live on the same land. How on earth would we ever pull that off?
Michael Biehn, that seems to present a conundrum.
Well, it's a problem that will occur only if we allow these species to get to the point where they are really in extremis. I think the lesson to be learned from potential conflicts like this is that we need to act sooner so that we have more options available to us and so that we can meet the needs of both the mountain plovers and the sage grouses through mechanisms that basically keep ecosystems functioning the way they're supposed to function. If they do that, then these species won't get to the point where they are in dire danger of extinction. We won't have these conflicts.
Richard Stroop will give you the last word, but we only have about 30 seconds for you, I'm afraid.
Well, if we can get rid of the sort of Damocles aspect of this law so that voluntary efforts can, in fact, prosper again, I think we'll make a lot of headway.
Richard Stroop, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Richard Stroop was on the phone with us from his office in Bozeman, Montana. He's a senior associate with the Property and Environment Research Center, and he's also an economics professor at Montana State University. Thor, by the way, thanks for listening, and thanks for the phone call.
You're welcome.
Okay, and our thanks also to Michael Biehn, chairman of the Wildlife Program for Environmental Defense. He was with us here in Studio 3A. Remember, we will be doing a follow-up program on the future of the Endangered Species Act, though we were apparently talking quite a bit about that today already. But that'll be next week on Talk of the Nation, and tune in at that time. When we come back from a break, we're going to check in on the problems being faced by people in Ohio, an apparent serial sniper case.